The news will be up next.
On WSLR-LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV-LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Rick Knowlton with your WSLR news headlines for Thursday, April 17th, 2025. The Manatee Board of County Commissioners has earmarked a catalytic loan towards a 156-unit affordable housing project in Bradenton. The loan of $5.6 million is intended to attract further investment to fund the $28 million project. Frederick Piccolo Jr., former spokesman for Governor DeSantis, is more recently known as the marketing director under New College's new regime, which espouses conservative Christian values. Piccolo was arrested Tuesday for exposing his genitals in public. Again, his fourth arrest for indecent exposure, including one last August at Banana Republic. After this fourth arrest, Piccolo has, alas, been fired. Sarasota's award-winning annual financial report is now available. Complete with pie charts, figures, and scenic photos, this page-turning booklet can be found on the City of Sarasota Government Facebook page. Sea Alliance of Sarasota, a group committed to building a sustainable community of engaged citizens, has just come back from a road trip to Tallahassee, where they met with state legislators across the political spectrum, finding common ground to stand against book bans and protect our public schools. More info at seeourpower.org. That's seeourpower.org. The Manatee School District is holding two job fairs for interested applicants. The first one for services such as transport, food, and maintenance is today at 2 p.m. The job fair for teachers and paraprofessionals will be Saturday morning, April 26th. Find details and registration at thebradentontimes.com/news. This has been Rick Knowlton with your WSLR news headlines for Thursday, April 17th, 2025.
WSLR is supported by listeners like you and by Ringling College Galleries and Exhibitions. Ringling College's 2024-2025 exhibition season features art from Ringling students, alumni, faculty, and nationally recognized artists from a wide range of mediums and from diverse backgrounds. More information available at ringlingcollege.gallery.
Thank you for joining us. You are listening to The Detail on WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, and WBPV 100.1 LPFM in Bradenton, Florida. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. And programming at WSLR is supported by listeners like you and by Ringling College Galleries and Exhibitions. Ringling College's 2024-25 exhibition season features art from Ringling students, alumni, faculty, and nationally recognized artists from a wide range of mediums and from diverse backgrounds. More information is available at ringlingcollege.gallery. And after some considerable technical glitches, I am so happy to welcome Tim Hafey to the program. Tim has a distinguished career in public service. He's been a federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C., a U.S. attorney for the Western District of Virginia, general counsel for the University of Virginia, Wahoo. We'll talk about that. We both went to school there. And he has been the chief investigative counsel for the January 6th committee. Tim Hafey, thank you so much for hanging in there with me and joining me. I appreciate it.
Sure, Kathy. Thanks for the invitation. It's good to be here.
Yes. Well, I have to say, for those who know you and went to school with you, who know you to be someone of great integrity and a stand-up guy, watching those hearings, it was great to see you there. And I know the quality of the work you do. Yeah. Absolutely.
Appreciate that, Kathy. Yes.
Yeah. So you have written a book. It's called Harbingers, What January 6th and Charlottesville Reveal About Rising Threats to American Democracy. And what a lot of people may not realize is that your work on the January 6th committee was preceded by your work leading an independent review of the events in 2017. The Unite the Right rally riot, when we saw Nazis marching on the University of Virginia in front of the statue of Thomas Jefferson in the rotunda. It's, you know, for those of us who know it and love it, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's a symbol of American democracy. And the stark contrast, obviously, was with white supremacists there. Certainly Jefferson has a very American story when it comes to his own, you know, owning slaves. And maybe it's a part of our history we haven't fully reckoned with. But I want to kick off our discussion by asking you, because I thought you made a great point in your book about the cocoon. I mean, I know when I was in Charlottesville, certainly in college, I felt like I was in a cocoon. You know, when you're an undergrad, you have a very small world. But you wrote about that being a professional practicing law in Charlottesville. Can you talk about that and how also the August 2017 riot was preceded by other events, white supremacy demonstrations? So can you just tell the audience what happened in Charlottesville and why did it kind of pierce a cocoon for you?
Yeah, appreciate that question. So I live in Charlottesville still. I've been there for a little over 20 years, where you and I met, Kathy, going to school years ago, is where I've, you know, raised my family and where I live. So August 11th and 12th of 2017 were just really hard days for us when this large group of angry white men were there chanting offensive slogans, trying to provoke violence. That event was preceded by several other events. In the summer of 2017, we in Charlottesville were going through a very public community conversation about Civil War statues. We had a couple of Civil War statues, very prominent parks, and some members of the community felt like they were vestiges of racism and should be taken down. Other people in the community thought that they were badges of history and that they should remain or maybe be contextualized. So we were having this public conversation and these two UVA alums, Jason Kessler and Richard Spencer, very active in the kind of alt-right white supremacist movement, decided that in the midst of that discussion of statues, they would use Charlottesville as a forum to bring together this constellation of white supremacists. And in May of 2017, they kind of spontaneously descended upon the statue of Robert E. Lee. Coincidentally, it was on the day of our Festival of Cultures, kind of a multicultural festival that was happening in Charlottesville that day. Mm-hmm. They came with a permit, no pre-clearance from the city or from any official recognition, and just started, you know, ostensibly to support the statue remaining, but kind of about 100 people carrying flaming torches at night in a public place, you know, was a sort of a wake-up call for a lot of people in Charlottesville. It prompted, after the fact, a very strong anti-racist response. In July, there was a permitted event that the Ku Klux Klan chapter from North Carolina applied for and obtained. Mm-hmm. A lot of your audience needs to know that hate speech is protected speech, that the government does not make decisions based on the content of speech, unless it directly incites violence, you know, in imminent lawless action, or it directly threatens an identifiable individual or group, it's protected. So no matter how noxious the speech was, the KKK rally was permitted, and the city prepared to essentially protect everyone present at the event. About 30 Klansmen came, thousands of anti-racist, I don't want to call them counter-protesters. They weren't really protesting anything. They were just strongly in opposition to the Klan. And the Klan came in and left sort of protected by this phalanx of state police and local police officers. And that really drew the ire of the crowd, such that after the Klan members departed under that protection, the police declared an unlawful assembly and deployed tear gas. And that created a very strong backlash.
They used tear gas on those who were there to oppose.
Yes.
The Klan.
Yes. Okay. Because the crowd that was there to oppose the hate speech made it difficult for the Klan vehicles to depart, and then started to spar with law enforcement, and they declared an unlawful assembly. They deployed tear gas, and it created, as you can imagine, a lot of antipathy toward government and toward law enforcement. And then a month later, August the 12th, 11th and 12th happens. So there was a series of events over the course of the summer. I was hired by the city of Charlottesville. I was a lawyer in private practice. I had been U.S. attorney in that district that includes Charlottesville. And I was independent. You know, I was no longer a government official, but I had relationships with people throughout the community. Mm-hmm. And the city, to its credit, Kathy, hired me to do an independent report. So I was given access to every person, every document that that they had at their disposal. And I did a thorough examination of how my own client, the city, managed, prepared for, and then in real time managed the event. And it was a very critical report. It basically faulted the city council, the law enforcement leaders, for failing to protect public safety or free speech on August 11th, 12th. Very critical of our alma mater, the University of Virginia, for insufficiently protecting students that night. So that was my resume of sorts to then lead the January 6th investigation some years later.
Yeah, I think getting to this cocoon aspect, I think it reverberates. It has a lot of reverberations because for whatever reason, these things, you know, Robert E. Lee, the statue, it being controversial, there were two events preceding where the rally were a riot where a woman died, right?
Yeah.
On August 12th. And for whatever reason, as your report outlined, law enforcement and city council members didn't recognize how dangerous the situation was. What is missing in our conversation, at least from your independent review? What were the things you saw in there where the signs were missed, or, you know, local government, local law enforcement just dropped the ball? What was it?
Yeah. So the essence of law enforcement, the essence of decision making by law enforcement officers or agencies, is the assessment of danger. Whether it's an officer making a decision to stop a vehicle because of a perceived violation of law, or if it's an agency that's assessing intelligence broadly, that essentially is a subjective determination of a threat. Mm-hmm. And given how subjective it is, implicit bias, Kathy, creeps into that. I think that we in law enforcement collectively misassess danger in part based on the race of the individuals who present that danger. In Charlottesville and at the Capitol, these were, you know, largely middle-aged white guys who were perceived to be pro-police. And the assessment of the danger that they posed, regardless of the intelligence in advance of Charlottesville, in advance of the Capitol, was clear that there were people coming determined to engage in acts of violence, that this was not an intelligence failure. It's not a resource failure. There are plenty of officers of different agencies present both locations. They just were not sufficiently deployed. Because the reasons for that, one has to do with implicit bias. We misassess, underestimate danger when it comes from white men, and we overassess danger when it comes from black and brown protesters. You look at the summer of 2020 and the protests that erupted after the murder of George Floyd, and, you know, there are Humvees and officers in riot gear and a very different perception of danger. Now, to be fair, some of the the protest was against police, and therefore the mm-hmm. perception of danger was informed not just by race but by the perspective. But we keep getting this wrong in both directions. So I think we need to flag that as an issue. I didn't find, to be clear, explicit bias. I didn't talk to officers either place, either Charlottesville or the Capitol, mm-hmm. who were sort of on the side of the rioters or the protesters. Quite the opposite. They were very frustrated the fact that they were not preconditioned to do the right thing. You know, that we also don't share information very well among agencies. You know, what the FBI knows, the local police don't share, the state police, we're in silos. And some law enforcement agencies place real restrictions on their ability to use anything that is open source, right? The FBI has a terrible history of violating civil liberties, and they will not do anything with open source information, stuff that's protected speech, that's available in open forums, unless it is.
What do you mean by open source? I'm not really clear. Like
things that they see on social media, right? Somebody posts, a very concrete example. Someone posts a picture on Facebook of themselves with a AK-47. And the line is January 6th is like 1776. See you in Washington. Mm-hmm. That is protected speech. It's not sufficiently specific or credible for the FBI to open a preliminary investigation. Therefore, Kathy, it doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't get aggregated with other similar tips or postings. They don't go knock on the door of that person to ask about plans or intentions. It just essentially disappears. And as a result of the admirable desire to ensure that their investigative activity doesn't implicate free speech or free association, I think that they overcompensate and therefore miss intelligence gathering and intelligence assessment opportunity. So all of these factors kind of combined to make the law enforcement preparation for Charlottesville on January 6th ineffective.
Yeah. So you know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about was that in terms of policing, the police in Charlottesville were actually not out and among people talking to them. It wasn't like they were acting as beat cops walking with people. They were actually behind barricades. Can you share how that was problematic or didn't help?
Yeah, absolutely.
Situation?
A couple of specific failures, and some of this gets to your earlier question about the sort of learning that I was able to gain from my own work in Charlottesville and the cocoon that I kind of broke out of. They hardened this park around the Lee statue. Their focus exclusively was on the park, the event.
Yeah.
They had no focus whatsoever on the ingress and egress, which is sort of shocking failure to say people got to get there, right? And you've got racists walking down city streets with flags and chanting, you know, Jews shall not replace us, surrounded by lots and lots of angry, anti-racist people with different perspectives. That's a recipe for disaster. As a matter of fact, the explicit intention of a lot of the Unite the Right rally goers was to provoke violence. They wanted to be the responders, not the aggressors. And they knew that if they marched through a college town, they were baiting people. Exactly right. They knew that their words would provoke violence. And that was fairly obvious, but yet the police did not sufficiently protect. The other thing they did, Kathy, is that they protected the downtown mall. The downtown mall in Charlottesville is it's Main Street, it's bricked over. There's no vehicular traffic, mm-hmm. and it's got a lot of high-end restaurants and art galleries and stores. And they were very focused on protecting the downtown mall, which is only a block south of the Lee statue in the park. Mm-hmm. So even after violence has started and people are brawling in the street, just a block south, mm-hmm. you've got these officers in riot gear protecting businesses. And that was an indication. A lot of people in Charlottesville said, well, of course, law enforcement, you know, protects property over people, particularly poor people. Mm-hmm. And what I went into thinking, man, what a hard situation for law enforcement, really difficult. A lot of people that I talked to said, you know what, that's just the way it is every Saturday night in my community. And they didn't expect the city, the law enforcement or city government to be there to protect and serve them. So I had this sort of naive sense of my community as this, you know, really healthy and productive place, lots of economic opportunity and natural beauty. And But a lot of people in Charlottesville have a very different lived experience, and they see institutions like law enforcement, like city government, like the city's educational system. There's a huge achievement gap between sort of affluent students and poor kids. They see these systems as dysfunctional and as not effective. And I saw that other side, that cynicism about the institutions in a way that I hadn't fully appreciated, even though I live in that community. And that was a lesson to me, right? Like this disconnect that we have in lots of communities. Charlottesville is not unusual between insiders and outsiders. That to me was really instructive.
Yeah. So, you know, looking at January 6th, again, although I don't know that you could say there were precursors, but there was definitely chatter. I had a guy I know who in Sarasota, this was during COVID, and I would go downtown to Pastry Art, and I would often see Martin Hydes, who my listeners are going to know who Martin Hyde is. Anyway, and Martin is, you know, we agree on many things, actually, but, you know, he's definitely more to the right, I'm more to the left. And he said to me, so Kathy, he was joking, are you going to be in D.C. on Wednesday? And I was like, what are you talking about? And he started laughing. And he told me what was, like, there was going to be this, you know, protest or against certification of the election, and everyone's going to be. And I said to him, Martin, do you ever think, like, there's any potential harm in what you might be doing here? Like, it doesn't sound, you know, I was just like, what are you doing? So we had a whole contingent. I mean, there were buses that went up that our state senator, Joe Gruters, let people know. And listen, people have a right to assemble, you know. But I think the violence against law enforcement was shocking. Well, the whole thing was shocking, but there was a lot of chatter. And, you know, I look at, I want to ask you about the lessons learned there and parallels to Charlottesville. But I also think that the country, when they're asked, you know, when these polls ask American citizens, are you okay with the January 6th, those who were, you know, convicted of violence against police, are you okay with them being pardoned? The numbers I've seen, you know, 83% say no. I mean, this is very disturbing. It's one thing to disagree politically, which is always going to happen.
Sure.
To lose the rule of law and to lose respect for police and to no longer recognize the difference between peaceful assembly and feeling entitled to beat police. I mean, I think we have to recognize the gravity of where we are, and that just because it was 4 years ago, this is still a dynamic we have to contend with. So I'm just interested, you know, comments and the parallels between the two events, Charlottesville and January 6th.
So one of the things that your question raises is how siloed people that live in this country are when it comes to information. So your conversation with Martin Hydes is a good example, Kathy. He's probably consuming a lot of information about this event, and you had not really focused on it or heard of it.
Right.
So he's getting information from some sources very different from yours. That's really common in this country. Like, you and I grew up in an information ecosystem in which, you know, there are few television networks, a couple of big newspapers, and they were held to a legal standard of balance. Now, more and more in this country, most people get their information through curated, algorithm-driven social media feeds. They are not getting sources directly, you know, balanced sources as original. They're only getting links that are fed through a program that is designed to get and maintain their interest, right? To the whole ball game with social media platforms is to get users on the platform and to keep them there
in an addictive way. They're feeding an addictive. Yeah,
precisely. It is addictive. And when you engage on something or click on an article, that is information that is used to feed you more and more similar content. And a lot of that content is just false. A lot of people at the Capitol sincerely but mistakenly believed that the election was stolen, was infected with fraud because of their consumption of information in the silos. And that is a new phenomenon, and we have to reckon with that information ecosystem in which we don't agree on core facts. People believe, read, and consume different sets of facts. The other thing your question raises is sort of the pardons and the rule of law. Look, I believe the basis of the work that I did in Charlottesville on January 6th was that facts should matter. Like, the recovery from these kind of horrific events has to start with just a baseline. What happened? Let's just tell the truth, the story of what happened. And that then becomes a basis for accountability, for recovery, for learning, for prevention in the future. Accountability is essential, that if we're going to respond appropriately as a democracy, there has to be accountability. You know, in Charlottesville, a bunch of people got fired, lost their jobs, law enforcement leaders, and there was a huge criminal investigation in the wake of the attack on the Capitol, the biggest in the history of the Justice Department, and it ultimately led to the indictment of the now president, as you know. Mm-hmm. But the fact that that accountability was wiped away with the stroke of a pen is extremely disappointing and does threaten the rule of law. And that only is going to embolden, in my view, not just those people, but other people to engage in acts of political violence, right? It's very old fashioned. If you sanction something with a negative consequence, it's less likely to recur. If you essentially permit something explicitly or praise it, that's also more likely to occur. So my fear is that the accountability being missing after January 6th is one of many direct threats to the rule of law that we've seen in the last few months.
I want to ask you, because you were a federal prosecutor.
Yeah.
You worked for DOJ, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
I think a lot of us were assuming, well, DOJ must be doing something, right? Merrick Garland must be doing something. We're just not hearing about it. There must be something going on behind the scenes. And what unfolded, then your committee, you know, your work became known and out there. I think the most shocking thing for me, I'm just talking about me, is that it seemed like nothing. They were like, it just looked like Merrick Garland didn't do anything. Do you want to comment on that? Like, what?
I mean, it's hard for me to tell because I wasn't, you know, in the department any longer. It was clear to us, Kathy. I will say that it was clear to us that a lot of really important witnesses who were directly involved had not been interviewed. Right, we were getting to them first. Right, these are people like Cassidy Hutchinson and Pat Cipollone, centrally involved. I think the Department of Justice was really focused on what I've called sort of the blue collar part of the case, the violence at the Capitol. That's understandable, an appropriate place, but they weren't very much focused on the white collar part of this, the political effort to pressure state officials, to use the Justice Department to do things without foundation, to pressure Mike Pence to, you know, accept these fake slates of electors, the creation of those fake slates. Like, there's a lot going on.
Oh, yeah.
Not at the Capitol, but elsewhere that, you know,
here. The puppet masters, right?
Exactly.
I mean,
they weren't focused on that early enough, in my view.
Yeah. You know, my brother Jimmy said something to me. You know, my brother Jimmy was saying to me, you know, when you buy into, when you are going to vote for a particular group or party, no matter what, he said, what you've done is you've made yourself a pawn, you know?
Yeah.
And for me, what you're touching on right now, so I used to work in pharma, and I'm going to go off in a different direction, but I think you've prosecuted some important pharmaceutical cases as well. Okay.
We did, yeah.
Yeah. Purdue Pharma, paying a fine for them is nothing. It is the cost of doing business. Yeah. It is not a punishment. It means nothing. So these were the folks who knowingly marketed OxyContin, which behaves like heroin in the system and is that addictive. And they knew what they were doing. They knew. So to fine Purdue Pharma billions of dollars when they have more, you know, tons and tons of money, more than that, doesn't mean a thing. Until these people go to jail, you know, we have founder of Moms for Liberty, Bridget Ziegler, and Christian Ziegler, former chair of the Florida GOP, who had to step down over some colorful accusations recently last year. But Mr. Ziegler's job, he has a company called Micro-Targeted Media. And this algorithm-driven political advertising, you know, that is dangerous. It's not like there's an FCC, right, for the internet. We don't have that. And I don't know what the avenue is for accountability with these folks. But in my view, someone like Christian Ziegler, who is fomenting agitation, and he is using people's religious beliefs, their love for their children, you know, and agitating them to make our school board nuts, right? To make things so horrible. Until we find a way to keep him, you know, to address what he's doing, to address the white collar puppet masters that are manipulating, we're going to be in trouble.
Yeah.
But I have one other thought too. I talk to groups on the right and the left about dark money, and they are united in their repulsion, their deep repugnance for the way our government has become bought. You know, really
justifiable. I get it.
And they're really united against corruption. And I think, you know, there's such a link between corruption and these white collar, you know, agitator criminal types that are, you know, like an Alex Jones, who is a talented orator that is creating such problem in the country. And I'm going in a different direction, but do you see an avenue? You know, I think we need to repeal Citizens United. I think there's a lot of heavy lifting that has to happen in our society. But what are your thoughts about any of that? That's a lot.
It is a lot. But you know, as investigators are trained to do, let's start with a factual basis.
Yeah.
After the 2020 election, even after President-elect Biden was declared the winner, the Trump campaign continued to raise hundreds of millions of dollars, pivoting from the Trump for President campaign to the Stop the Steal movement. So the same people that were getting text messages and emails incessantly in the lead up to the election suddenly were getting solicitations to contribute to something called an election defense fund, which did not exist. You know, we're being told in these fundraising solicitations, the election was fraudulent and we need your money to fight back. And the Stop the Steal campaign, all of that money went to the Save America PAC, a leadership PAC controlled by President Trump. It was about $250 million between November the 8th, when the election was declared for President-elect Biden, and Inauguration Day. Mm-hmm. Frankly, Kathy, that message still is perpetuated and is still a cash generator. And it's completely lawful. So political advertising after Citizens United and Buckley v. Valeo and lots of Supreme Court authority is protected speech, right? It is commercial speech. It's protected speech. Corporations have First Amendment rights and can give unlimited amounts of money. Mm-hmm. So can super PACs. They're not held to the same standard as advertisers. Like if you put on a false advertisement, right, claiming that your product has benefits that it doesn't have, that is actionable by the FCC or otherwise. That does not apply to political ads. And to be clear, both political parties heavily engage in this, right? I get text messages and emails as a Democrat all the time, right, with outrageous claims about what President Trump is doing. So both sides here are invested in this, I think, unholy marriage between big donors and small donors, and the incessant flow.
Nobody's
hands are clean. And look, the members of our committee, you know, we were providing this information and raising the possibility of a recommendation that, hey, maybe we should look at campaign finance reform because of how controversial it was. It wasn't something that either side really wanted to tackle because they both benefit from it. So that fuels the cynicism, and that's part of what underlies that lack of faith in institutions is when you add gerrymandering to this mix. So as you know, right, most districts at the state or federal level are drawn to be safely Republican or safely Democratic. The only way you lose is if you're incumbent, is if you're outflanked to the extreme. That pushes our politics to the extreme. It discourages compromise. And when you add the special interest money, largely flows to incumbents, there's just not a lot of political competition or any real incentive to compromise. And that makes our politics even more polarized.
Yeah. You talk about anger versus apathy. And, you know, I think, well, one of the things, and you make great points about how we need to be engaging, right, with each other.
Yeah.
And we need to be participating. One of the things I take issue with is that, you know, things becoming so polarized that the other side is wrong about everything. And I actually,
yeah,
like I said about Martin Hyde, actually, there are plenty of things that Martin Hyde agree on.
Sure.
Probably more, you know, than the things we disagree on when it comes to certainly local politics. But there is this... Pete used to call it the fascism of the left. And this was before any of this started happening. But we used to feel like, you know, if you took a conservative position, you were a bad person, right? Because you weren't enlightened like me. And it was a real turnoff. My sister Marianne voted for a Democrat for the first time in 2020 or 2016 for Hillary Clinton because, you know, she's like, I can't vote for Donald Trump. If you know, we grew up in New York, and New Yorkers understand his history and the lies and the bankruptcies and all of that. So it's a lot more exposure to him. But I have to say, you know, that feeling of kind of a superior, I've got the moral high ground, and you see it on both sides. So,
yeah,
that anger around corruption. And that anger around a disrespect toward each other, if we're not on the same page about everything. That's one piece I want to ask you about. And the other is apathy. And I agree with you because you conclude that apathy is actually more dangerous. So you start wherever you want to start.
It is.
That one. Yeah. So
First of all, I think that cynicism, I think the fundamental divide in this country is no longer right versus left, but it's rather those who believe in institutions and those who don't. Those who, frankly, are invested in them and those that think that those institutions only serve a privileged few, right? And uh-huh. by institutions, it's government, it's media, it's education. It's a lot of those pillars that folks have, you know, in American society have traditionally relied upon for protection, for safety, for enlightenment, for everything. Mm-hmm. So there are a couple different reactions to that. If you have that cynicism about institutions, you can either get mad and you can storm the Capitol, right? That we saw an eruption of that cynicism. Mm-hmm. Both Charlottesville and the Capitol, to me, were really forms for grievance. That these were both incidents that started with an impetus, like the statues in Charlottesville, the election at the Capitol. But there were a lot of people there that were really just mad about lots of different things beyond that core impetus. They became just the sort of broad forums for people to express their anger.
Yeah.
So that's one reaction. The other reaction, though, is apathy. And that's what I'm hearing more lately, Kathy. And I agree with you that I think that is just a bigger threat to democracy. What I think unfortunately happens is that a lot of people, given their cynicism, don't think it matters. Don't think that they need to read different sources of information and educate themselves. Don't think that they need to engage in civic life. Don't need to talk to their neighbors. They assume the worst in them. They don't need to vote. And when people step back from participation in democracy, they give outsized power to these perspectives that aren't always for the common good on the right and the left. So to me, the sort of bottom line recommendation in my book is that, you know, democracy comes down to people. It comes down to regular people deciding that they need to do their part individually to protect democracy in their own lives, in their own circles, in their own communities. It's like you having a conversation with Martin Hines, right? That's democracy.
Yeah.
Listening to each other, trying to find points of connection, realizing that we have more in common than things that separate us, regardless of politics. Mm-hmm. If everybody took that attitude, right, and made an effort themselves to show up in a democracy in a very vibrant way, then I think we're fine. I have a lot of faith in the American people. If everybody participates, I think we're going to be good. The problem is that not everybody does. In the 2024 election, only 66% of registered voters voted. So this notion that, you know, President Trump has this land, you know, this landslide victory in a mandate is ridiculous, because only 66% of registered voters voted. That doesn't even touch all the voting age adults who didn't register. So when people sit back and don't participate, whether it's voting or otherwise, they need their power. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So everybody needs to participate, Kathy. Everybody needs to care. Everybody needs to engage. Everybody needs to do their part. If that happens, then democracy is in good hands.
Yeah. You know, a friend of mine was talking about just local stuff happening in the city. And she years ago said to me, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu, you know.
Yeah, that's accurate.
So, and you know, one of the things, again, I'm getting back to the puppet master white collar aspect of those who are agitating and instigating and fomenting anger about, you know, issues around sexuality, which, by the way, we're never all going to agree on. Right? That's just not something, or issues about religion. There's going to be differences of opinion about all that stuff. So what I see is they're getting people all worked up about these things where there's just going to be inherent disagreement. And we do have to collectively deal with our disagreements, and like in public schools, and find ways that, you know, a conservative Catholic family is as comfortable as, you know, two moms, you know, a gay couple raising their kids. How can everybody's realities be respected, right? And the kids do well in public schools. That's something we have to learn to deal with. But so these folks are getting everybody all worked up about that, you know, and I laugh when I saw Glenn Youngkin in his Mr. Rogers sweater going around when he was, to me, I'm like, you're really agitating people. And I'm not saying there weren't real issues in schools. There are. But then behind the scenes, and I understand people's anger, they're allowing themselves to be, in my view, distracted, but there is an oligarchy type movement it is an oligarchy for some people to benefit from the institutions of government through contracts, through tax breaks, through, you know, all kinds of means. It's, I don't think these folks who are looking to manipulate others, they want the government to work for them, and they distract people from how government, for the last 40 years, the systems are being dismantled that were working for people. Like the post-World War II economic reality gave rise to the middle class in a way that, yep, you know, is unique in this country. So again, getting back to the bought government, That to me is the real issue. Do you see a way that the apathy, and I agree with you, can be broken in that regard? It's hard because people running for office are rewarded by the system that's in place.
Right. And they're not going to kill themselves. So yeah. A couple thoughts, Kathy. One, what we're dealing with respect to that fundamental divide between insiders, outsiders, those who believe in institutions and those who don't, was not created by President Trump and is bigger than he. I think he is a business person who recognized that, has exacerbated it and exploited it and plays to it. But he didn't create it, right? There are a lot of people. He's only president because of this, because he recognized this sort of anger. He foments it, as you said, he and others around him.
Right.
But he didn't create it. And it'll be here after he
leaves.
The and we that's what we have to deal with. I think there's a scenario by which some of what he does will be a really plain overreach. You mentioned the parties, the pardons before, right? That I don't believe that was popular, even among a lot of diehard Trump supporters. And there's a scenario by which, you know, he tries to deport too many people, or these tariffs have real economic hardship. And a lot of the things that he does creates that stronger impetus to participate. You know, Dr. King and Barack Obama said, you know, the arc of history, it bends toward justice, but it's jagged. It sort of goes forward a couple steps, and then it goes backward. But the backward steps can unleash a more powerful reaction. And you see it all the time, like the Parkland shooting unleashes youth activism on the gun issue, and the Me Too movement, right, creates a very strong attention appropriately paid to sexual harassment. And like there could be a scenario by which these 4 years are so sort of beyond the pale, and some things that happen kind of make it harder for people to sit on the couch and not get concerned. Yeah. And they therefore go march, and they do vote. So I'm hopeful that it prompts more engagement. But again, it's not just government. It isn't just voting. It's sort of, to me, the solution really is much more ground level, right? People need to do their part individually to fix it, instead of just waiting for the next election and voting for somebody that they think will better align with their values in their own communities. They need to do it. The analogy here that I really like comes from New York. You mentioned you're from New York. When I was preparing to be the chief investigator for the Jan 6 committee, I read the 9/11 commission report, because I sort of saw that as the gold standard. And there's a story in there, Kathy, about New York City firefighters. One of them says, we're trained to go toward the fire, right? We run up the stairs when the burning building is on fire. That's what we do. Yeah. And I love that analogy, because it's exactly how we should look at what's going on in America right now, right? There's a lot of fires out there, and we need to run toward the fire. Like, we can't run the opposite way and say, nah, you know, nothing that I could do matters. No, now's the time that we got to all be like New York City firefighters and run toward the fire in ways large and small, from voting to making an impact in our own community. So that, I think, is the key to how we get through this. It is enduring the turbulence of these 4 years, and it's engaging in democracy and taking personal responsibility.
Yeah. You know, I think during the January 6 hearings, we saw somebody like Cassidy Hutchinson. There were a lot of staffers whose names that we didn't know, you know, but they're in the rooms, and they're in the rooms. They're privy to a lot of what's going on. And I think the courage, what's going to make the difference is the courage of that everyday person, right?
Right.
Like
exactly.
Like, I think Sarah Matthews, she was another one that, you know, came forward and she told her story. I was watching a report last night about, appears there, you know, a person at the Department of Labor reported a data breach. And he also experienced very close surveillance of himself that was meant to intimidate him and keep him from the reporting the breach he's concerned about, that it may have went to a foreign power. There's just a lot of question. And he said, I hope I'm wrong. Like, I hope this isn't true, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I look at him like, these are the people whose names we don't recognize, the people who are showing up for the country, doing public service work. I'm concerned that unfortunately we're going to learn the value of good, decent government workers, because we're losing so many of them.
And yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, it's a hard way to learn the lesson. But when these folks show up and they're not afraid, and we support them, that's going to be, I think, what makes the difference. You know, I think sometimes in this country, it's important to have good leaders, and we want to have, it'd be great to have a messiah, right, who leads us out of the jungle that we're in right now. But you and I talked before the show that I think it's a bottom up. Democracy is always, you can't have it unless you've got people who know what's going on and who are fed, like people who have enough food on the table. Keeping people poor is a way to keep authoritarians in power. So,
yeah. There's a chapter in my book that is called "There Is No Cavalry Coming." Right, Eric Holder, who's one of my personal role models, a former boss and a friend of mine, right after President Trump was, you know, secured enough delegates to get the Republican nomination in 2024, he tweeted, you know, "There is no cavalry coming." Right, we are the cavalry. We have to do. We can't wait for the Republican process to defeat him. And I think that has broader application, right? There is no external force that is going to ride in and save us. We have to save us. The other thing, there's another chapter in the book that's called "It's Hard to Hate Up Close." This is a Michelle Obama quote. She describes very eloquently that many times during the time her husband was president, those 8 years, she encountered people that she knew were hostile or were skeptical about her and her husband. But then when they spent time together, when they shared a meal, they talked about their kids, or there was some natural disaster that they were there to sort of respond to, then those barriers broke down. And she believed if she and her husband could just meet everybody in America, right, we'd be okay. And I think that's right. Like, it's hard to demonize somebody who you know. Like, it's your keeps going back to your Martin Hines story. Yeah. You may have very different perspectives on certain issues, but it's hard to hate up close, and we don't have enough places in America where we're up close, right? We're at a distance. We're in our like electronic silos and we're not finding ways for shared experience. And I keep coming back to that. I think it's just so important for us as a way forward.
Yeah. Yeah, it totally is. I really appreciate you being here. Your book is called Harbingers, What January 6th in Charlottesville Reveal About Rising Threats to American Democracy. And before we end, I have to, you know, when I was so enthralled with UVA, being from New York, but then when I went down to study there, it's a beautiful campus and it was a different culture. You know, the South, when I went to Monticello, there were a couple things. One was they were referring to the housing outside of the houses, the servants' quarters. And I said, you mean slaves, don't you?
Yeah.
Slaves.
Yeah. Important difference.
This woman in her beautiful Southern, well, yes, that's true. They were slaves. And I was like, yeah, you know, they didn't want to reckon with that. And I was at, you know, my ex-husband, his family was from Richmond, well, originally New York, and but settled in Richmond. And when the DNA from Jefferson establishing his paternity of Sally Hemings' kids published in the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Monticello Society came out with something like, "Well, we're still not sure."
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm like, yeah, I think it's pretty clear. And so to the extent that, you know, Jefferson was a man of his time and a flawed human being, and I think he wrote a document that he well knew was the basis for a different society. And they knew, our founding fathers knew that they weren't there yet, you know?
Your point about history is so important, because I really believe this goes back to something we talked about a few minutes ago, that we got to start with truth. We got to start with facts. Like, you look at the South African, you know, reconciliation post-apartheid. You look at how Germany has statues that commemorate the sad history of the Holocaust, right? Like, they're running toward the problem and acknowledging their history.
Yeah.
UVA does a much better job now, Kathy. If you took a tour of the university now, you would hear about the slave quarters and you would hear stories about enslaved workers. There's a memorial to enslaved laborers. So the university's gotten better at kind of honestly reckoning with its history. It's complicated. It's just like Jefferson. There is incredible vision and there's also some real human tragedy. in the choices that he made in his life. But that's, we got to be honest about that. Like some of the way forward has to start with an honest assessment of where we've been. And that's why I hope that the reports that I've been involved in, that's what they were meant to do, to be a baseline of fact from which we can learn. Like, let's be honest about what happened and not gloss it over or sugarcoat it. So that's part of democracy. It's telling the truth about things that have happened in the past, as hard as that truth may be.
Yes. And one of my favorite founding father quotes, John Adams said, "Facts are stubborn things."
Yes, exactly. He's right. They still are.
Yeah. They don't stop being facts just because you don't talk about them.
And that's exactly right.
Integrate that where, you know, we do need to do that work. Thank you so much, Tim. It's great to
see
you.
Yeah, Kathy, thanks for having me. Thanks for the truth that you're bringing to your audience in Sarasota. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and your audience.
I'm so glad you came. Everybody, you've been listening to The Detail on WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, and WBPV 100.1 LPFM in Bradenton, Florida. Make it a great day.
Support for WSLR comes from the Fabulous Arts Foundation, presenting the Be Fabulous Music and Arts Pride Festival on Saturday, May 10th, at Five Points Park in downtown Sarasota. The festival celebrates and supports the LGBTQ plus community with performances by Bera from Washington, D.C. and Giella from Atlanta, along with local artists Meteor Eyes, Hovercar, and many more. More information at fabaf.org. Get ready to dance on Saturday, April 19th at 8 p.m. Otto Duniel y su son Sabroso bring the rhythms of Cuba to Fogartyville. Known as the golden voice of Cuban sun, Otto delivers an electrifying night of Latin music with rich vocals and irresistible grooves. Doors open at 7 p.m. Tickets are $22 for members, $26 for non-members, and $13 for students 13 and up. Learn more at WSLR.org.
Lights on, mic up. This is learning like you've never heard it before. Remake Learning Days Live is happening Friday, April 19th at WSLR, 525 Kumquat Court in Sarasota's historic Rosemary District, where kids and their adults step into the spotlight and become real radio storytellers. Sponsored by the Patterson Foundation, this one-day, hands-on adventure lets families team up to write, record, and broadcast their own radio segments guided by real broadcasters. Because everyone deserves a voice, a chance to be heard, a chance to share their story with their community. Choose your session, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. or 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Pre-registration is required, so don't wait. Sign up now at WSLR.org. or by calling 941-894-6469.